From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll hear from a group of young Wisconsin voters with different political views about how they're feeling ahead of the presidential election.
I feel like it is just like picking a lesser of two evils at this point, and I don't think that we should have to ever be put in that position.
Plus, we'll learn how one entomologist is changing hearts and minds on the importance of insects.
All it takes sometimes is a snippet of wonder and some imagination and some real-life examples of how insects have interacted or related with humans throughout history to really inspire and alter people's perspectives about insects.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Young voters could be key in deciding November's presidential election. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, Gen Z and millennial voters make up nearly half of the electorate, and over 8 million Gen Zers will be eligible to vote for the first time this year. WUWM brought together a group of young voters as a part of our roundtable series, where we talk to local voters about what issues are important to them. On October 14th, four voters from the Milwaukee area, all in their 20s, joined us in our studios to talk about their concerns ahead of the presidential election this year. The conversation was moderated by Lake Effect's Excret Nunez and WUWM Eric Vaughn Fellow Nadia Kelly. A note to our listeners, you'll be hearing people express their own personal and political opinions. Participants' answers may be edited for clarity and length.
So we're really close to the election. We're less than a month away, actually, from the election. So in a few words, how are you all feeling? We can start with Will, and then we can just go around the room.
Well, I guess I'll begin with my perspective on the election. I support Donald Trump for presidency. I'm feeling good about his chances. In terms of the main issues, I guess the reasons why I support him primarily, I think that he's a candidate that certainly is going to reduce legal immigration significantly. I think that immigration is the most important issue to me as a young voter. He's also someone that is going to, I think, induce a lot of economic prosperity with deregulation. And I guess we can expound on a lot of those issues more. But yeah, I think just in general, as a young voter, he's someone that really appeals to me as opposed to Kamala Harris.
And Will, you're a first-time voter?
Yes, in a presidential election.
Okay. And Sonia, how are you feeling ahead of the election?
I think right now I'm definitely feeling disheartened. I feel like I have to make a choice because I do think that voting is very important and I will be voting regardless of who my options are. I will not be voting for Donald Trump, that I can say confidently. However, I think that what's been on my mind recently has been everything going on in the Middle East and the suffering of the Palestinians. And it is very difficult to put that out of mind and vote for a candidate like Kamala Harris. I think Kamala Harris definitely has a leg up in terms of credibility, and her policies are a lot more appealing to me than Donald Trump's. But at the same time, like, I, as an American, want to cast a vote for somebody that I feel like inspires me and feel like will make America a place that I want to, that I'm proud to be a citizen of, you know. And I'm not saying that I'm not proud to be a citizen of America, but I feel like it is just like picking a lesser of two evils at this point. And I don't think that we should have to ever be put in that position. I think that there should always be a candidate that truly represents the needs, values, morals, and opinions of the American people.
Thank you.
All right, Des, you can go ahead.
I'm a bit nervous for the turnouts in a November election. I'm in favor of Kamala Harris. She just kind of appeals more to me. I would actually love to see a woman become president. So I wouldn't say that that's like my first reason, but it's definitely in my like top three. But I'll kind of piggyback off what she said. I'm not really sure when they get into office, whoever wins, at the end of the day, will they do what they said they're supposed to do? So that's why I'm always going to be undecided with who I really want to choose, because from just past reasons and experience, there's never really been a candidate that said, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And when they got into office, they actually did everything that they said they was going to do. You know, and that's important to me because, like, we give our vote to that person. We trust in that person. We kind of see them as, like, the celebrity status to make our dreams come true in a way. Right. So I'm kind of undecided.
And Victor, how are you feeling?
Yeah, I'm definitely feeling nervous for this upcoming election. I mean, at the start of this year, I thought I was like, oh, this is going to be interesting, you know, Trump versus Biden, round two. And then the first assassination attempt happened, then Biden dropping out, then the second assassination attempt. And I'm just like, wow, this is not on my bingo card, you know? But in all seriousness, when it comes to who I'm going to be voting for or supporting, I hesitantly support Kamala Harris, and I'm going to be voting for her the same reason I voted for Biden. It's because I oppose Trump and his policies, specifically on immigration, because I am a child of immigrants, and I feel like a lot of Trump's policies are, while they on paper seem to be like, oh, it's for the security of the country, I've seen the actual effects of some of his policies and how they have affected both friends and family. And I think, like Sonia said before, it's a lesser of two evils. And I don't like that I'm doing that. You know, it's ridiculous that, like, I have to just basically say, oh, well, this isn't at least going to a right-wing presidency, which is not something I want. But I want something more than that. You know, I don't want to just prevent somebody else from becoming president. I want to vote for someone who I actually want to be president. Like, Kamala, like, yeah, she did some, I would say, decent things as VP under Biden, but I'm not really excited for her. To be honest, I'm more excited for VP Tim Walz. Yeah, he is someone I'm actually more hopeful for, that he will push more progressive policies once. Well, I'm sorry, not once. Sorry, that's me being hopeful. If he were to be elected as VP.
Thank you so much for all of your answers to that question. It's really good that we got some opinions on what you think of the candidates as well. That sort of brings us to our next question. So if you had to vote for president today, who would you vote for and why? I think we got answers from a few of you already, but I know, Sonia, you have some conflicting ideas about Kamala specifically, or?
Both.
Both.
I think if I had to vote today, I would probably cast my vote for Kamala Harris. And as Victor said, like, hesitantly, I would cast my vote. I wouldn't be the most happy about it. I think that it is really great to see a Black woman running for president, and that is exciting. But at the same time, like, as far as even, like, her immigration policy is not what I would like to see from a left-leaning president. As much as her policies in my eyes are better than Donald Trump's by far, I still do not think that they satisfy me. And it's just, as far as, like, the whole genocide in Palestine, both parties have been very firm in their support, and they have not done much to interfere or to, like, hear out the cries of all of the Americans and other people around the world that have begged for this to end. Yeah, I'm gonna end it there before I go on a tangent. But but yeah, if I had to vote right now, I would cast a vote for Kamala Harris. But that is only because I have not heard a convincing case for a third party.
Thank you, Sonia. Really appreciate your answer. Dez, I know you're also feeling a bit undecided, but I want to ask the same question to you. If you had to vote for president today, who would you vote for?
Well, if I had to vote for a president today, I definitely would go with Kamala Harris. She just kind of fit my views more than Donald Trump.
Is there something, like, an issue in particular that you like that Kamala Harris is working on versus Trump?
Yeah, most importantly, education. And then second would be housing.
Thank you. So just to establish, Victor, if you had to vote today, who would you vote for?
I would vote for Kamala Harris, yeah.
And
I would vote for Donald Trump.
You're listening to Lake Effect. I'm Excret Nunez, here with WUWM Eric Vaughn Fellow Nadia Kelly. We're talking to a roundtable of four young Wisconsin voters about what's on their minds ahead of the presidential election.
So we're also really interested in learning about your guys' relationship to politics. What role did politics play in your household growing up? I'll start with Victor.
Of course, yeah. So I would say it started ever since I was a little kid, but it really wouldn't be about American politics. It would be about Mexico's or El Salvador's politics. And there was always like just a room of discussion, usually during Thanksgiving or Christmas, and they wouldn't get too deep into anything. But I grew up hearing that. And I would say when politics really took an influence in my life is during COVID, during like the BLM protest, I was exposed to a new way of thinking, because when I was at home alone, I was seeing all these people, you know, go on Twitter, TikTok, or any other type of social media and really explain their political view. And I really feel like it was that year in 2020, I really started to explore more that, you know, learning both the conservative, leftist, liberal, and right-wing political views and really understand what they want for this world and how my views really fit into it. So I would say that's been my journey. And up until right now, I would say I've taken a step back from politics a little bit, just because for me, I'm someone who got really invested, but to the point it was like unhealthy for me. Like I would just like, not to say I would scream at the top of my, at the top of the roofs, but I was just like, I would talk about the same things over and over instead of like going out and, you know, do community organizations or protest or, you know, help with fundraising. So I've done better at managing myself and investing my energy whenever I want to into something more political, such as, like you've mentioned before, with the genocide going in Palestine. I've tried to, you know, donate to some humanitarian aid, join protests and other similar activities like that.
Gotcha. What role did politics play in your household growing up, if any?
Well, growing up, politics really didn't play a role in my life. My parents didn't talk about it. My grandparents didn't talk about it. They come from just a family line of just trying to work, trying to stay afloat, being in middle class. So their focus wasn't really on politics. It was more just working. So it never really played a part in my life until I became an adult and I start working and I start having to pay taxes and I start really needing to know what's going on in my world and the stuff that's starting to affect me now. And I work at an organization called BLOC, and pretty much we go out and we do nothing but political work. So I'm very appreciative that I got in that line of work. So I'm very educated on everything that's going on now. I'm able to understand what candidates, their job roles, and what exactly they're supposed to do and how it aligns with my lifestyle. So I would say I really didn't pick up on it until I became an adult. So now I know it's very important for everybody, especially the youth, to know about politics and about voting in our candidates.
Sonia?
Similar to you, I also didn't have like a huge presence of like political conversation in my childhood at all. My parents are both immigrants. My mom lived in Kuwait and then went to India during the Gulf War. And then my dad is born and brought up in India. So to them, they came here to put their heads down and work and make something of themselves. And so we never really talked about politics. I didn't really know much about anything. I didn't like to pay attention in social studies. And then when I got to college, I took one political science class, and that's when I was like, where have I been my whole life? And then I also started working for an organization that did a lot of like canvassing and voter registration work. And that's when I learned more and I became more involved. And I started working with other organizations on my campus, student organizations, to start organizing around Palestinian liberation. And yeah, I think that like almost all of my political education came during my college years.
Thank you. And Will?
Yeah, so, you know, when I was young, political conversation wasn't super prevalent in my household, but, you know, I did grow up in a very Christian environment, so that definitely informed my parents' beliefs. You know, they were relatively conservative, I would say. I always was pretty conservative as well. I guess as conservative as like a 10-year-old can be, and how much does a 10-year-old really know about politics or the world, I guess. But really once I started to get to high school and I took more history classes, more social studies classes similar to Sonia, I became more involved with politics, or I guess more interested in it. But really when 2020 came around, you know, there was all this political stuff that was going on, specifically with, you know, the BLM riots and the election and COVID and all of that. And so it was was something where I kind of just couldn't really look away, you know. So I started to really look at a lot more perspectives, and I ultimately, you know, started to identify more as like a conservative around my friends and family and stuff. And I realized that, you know, I wanted to get involved in politics to help solve a lot of the issues that, you know, do exist in the country. And once I got to college, the first thing I did is I got involved with college Republicans. And once I did that, that kind of catalyzed my political involvement within the Republican sphere. During the Iowa caucus, I went down to Iowa in a blizzard, drove like 5 hours with like four of my friends, and we made tons of phone calls for President Trump. It was a huge initiative that the college Republicans did. Very successful. And then I also interned for Senator Ron Johnson 2 years ago, so that was a great experience. And then now I work for Turning Point Action as a ballot canvasser, or a ballot chaser, technically they call it. So yeah, I've been involved with a lot of political stuff, and it's been very fruitful.
So I kind of see like a theme going on here with everyone of like politics wasn't really something that was talked about at home growing up. It wasn't something that you really became interested in or involved in as maybe the issues started affecting you personally more, or you became interested in it more. I'm kind of interested of like, well, now we're all grown up. how do you discuss politics with your family and friends now? Or is that even a thing that you do? Is that off limits? I kind of just want to open it up to whoever wants to answer first.
Yeah. So I would say probably in my family, I'm the most politically active. And that's just because I've taken the most interest in politics in my family. And I come from a Catholic household, but we also have a more, I would say, progressive type of like thinking, I would say. So when I do talk about politics with family, there's not a lot of, I would say, tension or disagreement. You know, there are some things, but, you know, that's just older generations and their way of life. And I would say, just to go a little bit further, when I do talk about politics with my friends, which isn't as often just because, you know, we're just trying to have fun and yeah, we're just super busy as well. But when we do talk about politics, I'm very fortunate where a lot of my friends, we do feel the same way about certain issues. And I even have friends of mine who I know for a fact are like Republicans. And for those friends, I respect their opinion enough where it's like, that's their opinion. I'm not going to change their mind. They're grown adults. They're going to have their opinion. And I just avoid to talk about politics with them because I know that there are other things that we share, whether it's same experiences or background, where I can relate enough to them. And I try not to bring politics to ruin a friendship.
Yeah. Wow. It's really interesting to think about like mm-hmm. that. I guess a conversation like that could ruin a friendship yeah. or like hurt it. I guess.
Yeah, it's just for me, like, I talk about politics if I really feel like genuinely like I have the same opinion as someone, or I feel like they are open to mm. hear me. And my friends are either people who agree with me or people who I know will not agree with me no matter what. So at that point, you're just banging your head against the wall. Like, no point in talking about it.
Yeah, let's just talk about the fun stuff.
Exactly.
Anyone else who wants to chime in on that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll piggyback off of Victor a little bit. You know, I kind of said my parents weren't super political when I was younger, but as I got more involved with politics, they started to become more political just because I was talking about it more. And I think they just naturally gravitated towards it once I started talking about it. And actually, yeah, also similar to Victor, most of my friends have similar political sympathies as me. So it's like we kind of just talk about it and it's fun, you know, to know that you can have that conversation and you don't really have to worry about somebody screaming at you potentially. But I do have friends that have different political ideologies than me. Even with that, I can still talk to them about different issues, and we don't have to feel like we're, you know, screaming at each other and, you know, not having a cordial conversation. So, yeah, generally it's pretty good for me in terms yeah. of having those conversations.
Thank you. Sonia?
So my family definitely has also started to talk about politics a lot more since I've gotten more involved. My dad has always leaned more conservative, just he wants his money, you know. And then I did also grow up very religious. And so they have like more conservative social values as well. My dad actually did vote for Donald Trump the first time around, and then my mom would not have it after that. But we do have a lot of discourse, and it is interesting because even within my family, there is a lot of different opinions and perspectives, and we can rally behind the same opinion on some issues and be in like stark opposition on others. So, and I think that it always is important to have political conversations with people that have different opinions and perspectives from you, because there's no way that we can ever attempt to come to a understanding, you know, if you don't approach those conversations with an open mind and try to understand why this person may think the way that they think, because, you know, we're all products of our environments, you know, and our beliefs are products of that. And I think that today what we see is crazy polarization, and people just do not talk to each other, I feel like, in a respectful way when we're discussing like sensitive topics like that. And I think that it is very important to like give other perspectives that space and that respect, and like try to just trying to understand them rather than to convince them of something is something that can be very valuable.
Yeah, I think that actually really transitions us really well into the next question. We've learned a little bit about what you all like care about, but we would love to know more about the issues that are motivating you to vote. I know, you know, we've already talked a little bit about the conflict in Gaza. We've talked a little bit about immigration. Des, you brought up education and housing. Maybe we can start with you this time around.
Okay, well, for me, like I said, education is the most important. I just feel like a lot of schools, especially here in our Milwaukee area, like MPS schools, they need a lot of rebuilding and rebranding. I'm not sure what happened to all the money that they had, but they need more. And I just feel like if Kamala could focus on education a little bit more than anybody has, and maybe upgrade like the curriculum system, you know, a lot of our youth would thrive more. They wouldn't be focused on violence. They wouldn't be focused on, you know, things that they shouldn't even be worried about if they had like a solid education and a foundation that actually landed them into a position as soon as they're done with school. So education is always going to be the biggest thing for me, because I mean, you can't get anywhere without knowing something.
Yeah. And you also mentioned housing earlier too.
Yeah, housing, better options for homeowners. I just know when I go out indoors and I talk to like people of the neighborhood, home owning is like a big subject for them.
Mm-hmm. Are these issues that like affect you like personally too? I know you talked a lot.
Well, education, yes. Because I mean, I'm only 27. It wasn't that long before I was in school. I missed out on having a lot of trades in my school. Like I said, I have a son now, so I'm very fearful of how his future might be with the education system. And just, you know, I have a lot of brothers and sisters. There's a lot of people I know, and education really impacts us all, so.
Right, thank you. Is there anyone else that wants to talk about the issues that affect them personally, or issues that they care about?
Yeah, I guess I'll just elaborate quickly. You know, I kind of mentioned immigration and the economy. I think those are the two most important issues for me. Specifically as a young person that's about to graduate college, you know, I look at almost like the inability to buy a home because mortgage rates are so high. I mean, there's obviously depression in terms of the supply of housing. And so it's like, you know, someone who wants to have a family and wants to own a home at some point, it's like, you know, I look at that and I'm like, where's the ability for me to eventually do that? And I think that, you know, Trump is someone that has proposed economic plans that can eventually solve that in the future. And I just look at, you know, the economy in general, and it's like input costs are incredibly high. Inflation is still affecting a lot of stuff. And so we have to look at that and say, all right, well, which candidate is proposing the best economic plan? I think that's President Trump, or former President Trump, I should say.
I would like to say immigration, like I've mentioned before, is the most important topic for me, just because, like I've said, I'm a child of immigrants. Both of my parents, fortunately, were able to come here legally. My dad on a student visa, then applying for a citizenship, and my mom, a refugee from the Civil War, and eventually got her citizenship as well. But I know a lot of immigrants as well, or children of immigrants, who are here and they're not here legally, you know. And, you know, it's not like a lot of people like to say it's like, oh, they crossed the border, they went on a boat. A lot of times these people who are legal, deemed as legal immigrants, they just overstay their visas. That's how a lot of people who are staying in this country illegally. And I do agree that, you know, immigration should be an issue, but how I believe it should be dealt with is providing a path of citizenship for these immigrants, because I think it's well known that immigrants, they do provide a lot more to the economy than they do take out. You know, they're still paying taxes all the same, but they're still not receiving the same benefits as American citizens. And I feel like if we were to put more effort into properly integrating immigrants into this country, I feel like that would bring a stronger bond of being both an American and creating a stronger economy in general. Because when you have more legal workers, people who have more rights and representation, I believe we all strive together as Americans.
You're listening to Lake Effect. I'm ex-Grant Nunez, here with WUWM Eric Vaughn fellow Nadia Kelly. We're hearing the personal opinions of four young Wisconsin voters ahead of the presidential election.
A lot of people are wondering, how do young people even get their information? Like, where are they getting it from? So I just want to put out the question, like, how do you inform yourself about politics or the election? Like, where do you get your news from?
So for me, I do get a lot of my news from either political commentators, Instagram, TikTok. I will follow, you know, political accounts. I think probably one that I follow, some people might know, is Now This. It's on Instagram. You know, they talk about some issues that I deeply care about. And also a political commentator, I don't know if anyone knows this man. His name is Hassan Piker. He goes by Hassan Abi on Twitch. I do listen to some of his Twitch streams or YouTube videos. And I do have to say that I do agree with a lot of his points. And specifically when it comes to, I would say, more events concerning about Palestine, he does cover it more than I would say mainstream does, because just to put it simply, I believe that he goes to more sources than I believe mainstream would to really confirm the genocide that is going on in Gaza. So I follow political commentators, social media accounts, and sometimes I will take time for myself to actually look into it instead of just taking the word of somebody. Because at the end of the day, I need to know for myself.
Yeah. Check your sources.
Yeah.
Does?
I get a lot of my information from social media. I think for the young adults, that's pretty much our lives. So everything we see, everything we hear, everything we go through is going to be on there. Second would probably be my job. We have a political director, and his job is to, like, just know everything. So every blue moon, he comes and give us a presentation and just, you know, update us on everything that's going on as far as, like, the political side of the world.
Yeah. Is there anyone, like, on, I guess, do you go more on Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat?
I would have to say TikTok because the videos are so random. So there's always, like, a political video that pops up. There's always one about what just any violence that might have happened, any top news on the weather channel or news channel. So I don't really follow anybody specific. Mostly it's just scrolling, and if I see something interesting, I'll stop and look, you know, whether it is true or not.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Sonia?
Yeah, also social media. I get a lot of my information from my education as well. I think my professors do really stress the importance of staying up to date with current events. So through school and my work, and then probably, like, individual, like, political commentators, like you were saying, on, like, both TikTok and Instagram. And I think, yeah, obviously you have to be very careful with, like, the information that you're consuming on platforms like that. But I think that people have become so innovative nowadays, because really social media is the people's media. You know, it's the one source that is, like, hard to completely censor. So people will get very creative and, like, make full videos with their citations and, like, clips and links. And, like, I think that that's very helpful, and it'll lead me down a rabbit hole of, like, alternate articles online. But I think that social media definitely will be, like, the first one to tell me that something has happened.
Will?
Yeah, I'm going to concur with everybody else. I mean, I get pretty much all my news from social media and political commentators. If there's any, like, really breaking news, then I'll sometimes turn on, I guess, like, mainstream channels.
Yeah. I'm thinking, like, personally, not to bring myself into this, of, like, as a young person, social media, I feel like the algorithm is a huge thing. Like, social media will just feed you a lot of, like, similar stuff that you're already into, if that makes sense. Like, sometimes it feels like social media is this like bubble, if that makes sense. I don't know if you guys relate to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely is. Because, I mean, that's how those algorithms are designed. They're designed to feed you more content that will make you stay on the app longer. So, for example, me, I like more progressive content. I'm going to see more progressive content. For Will over here, he likes more conservative content. He's going to be receiving more conservative content. That's just how the algorithm mm-hmm. works for, like, YouTube and TikTok and other platforms like that.
Right.
I also don't think it's terribly different than, like, just consuming the regular news networks, because you're either going to watch Fox or MSNBC, or like you're more or less going to be in a bubble either way.
Hmm. So this roundtable was specifically for young people. What do you want listeners to understand about young voters? And like, I don't know what their idea of a young voter is.
I guess for me specifically, I mean, I think just to understand that we do care, because I feel like there's a lot of sentiment from especially older generations that, you know, young people don't really care about anything. We're kind of lazy. We don't have any like substance to us. And it's like, well, you know, we actually are getting politically involved. And we are doing things sort of to progress the future of America and sort of to make it great again, I guess.
Des, you were kind of chuckling over there to yourself. Is there anything else that resonated to you about Will's answer?
Yeah, how the older generation sees the youth. I would just say, you know, to give us grace, because it will take us time to get to their age and their views and be set in our ways. But I would advise parents and also the older generation to just keep educating us and learn from us, and we can teach you guys things as well. And as far as like the political side of the world, just start putting more information out for your kids and getting them, you know, used to learning about certain things and educating themselves, because one day they're going to have to vote, and one day the issues that affect the older generation will affect us.
That was a group of young Wisconsin voters: Will Caldwell, Sonia Syed, Des Woods, and Victor Chavez. This was WUWM's fourth voter roundtable, and you can listen back to our previous ones with more Wisconsin voters at WUWM.com. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Did you know Americans once farmed black widow spiders for their silk? Coming up next, we'll learn how humanity's ancient relationship with bugs has changed our world. Keep listening to Lake Effect on WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Insects may sometimes seem like a scourge on humanity, but without them, our lives would look very different. The quintillions of insects that inhabit our world help feed us, clothe us, and have changed the way we interact with one another. A new book called The Insect Epiphany explores the ancient relationship between humanity and insects. Author Barrett Klein is an animal behavior biologist and entomologist at UW-La Crosse, and he joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to explore more.
When you talk with people, what are the general perceptions of insects and their contributions to humanity?
Oftentimes, conversations can begin with trepidation, repulsion, fear, or general curiosity. And I think all it takes sometimes is a snippet of wonder and some imagination and some real life examples of how insects have interacted or related with humans throughout history to really inspire and alter people's perspectives about insects. So for example, I study something a little odd. I study sleep behavior in social insects, and people cock their heads and think about that, and they ask, you know, note that they didn't even know that insects slept, right? And what does that mean to sleep? And similarly, when you bring up examples of clandestine ways in which insects have infiltrated our culture, in very positive respects, it can open people's minds and eyes.
This book is really full of interesting ways that insects have kind of infiltrated our lives, and then the ways in which we have drawn from insects to benefit our lives. As you were putting together this book, what were some of the most surprising facts for you as someone who is really deep in this world?
Yeah, there were so many. And that was actually the biggest joy of writing this book, was the idea of jumping down rabbit holes and really learning about not only the overt, explicit ways like honeybees and their honey and beeswax and pollination contributions and butterflies and as symbols culturally affecting dances and indigenous people's rights, but then the really secret hidden ways that I never expected could exist. So for example, when I was exploring the most ancient ways that peoples had associated with insects, one example that kind of blew me away was the oldest complete and decipherable sentence in any alphabetic script was found on a little comb, a fine-toothed nit or louse comb to remove head lice. And the 17 letters spell out, "May this tusk root out the lice of the hair and the beard." The great part was the archaeologist Garfinkel, Josef Garfinkel, who was one of the discoverers, responded to one person with, "What were you expecting? A love song? A recipe to make pizza?" But for example, who was the first astronaut in space? It wasn't Yuri Gagarin, and it wasn't a dog. It wasn't a chimpanzee. It was fruit flies in 1946 and then 1947. Who was the first earthling to give birth to offspring conceived in space? It was a cockroach on Europe's Photon M3. And then where did the ink come from for some of the most famous documents in history, like the Declaration of Independence and the Magna Carta and the US Constitution? Well, it's from oak gall wasps producing oak gall ink. Plants protecting themselves as the developing insects would instigate a chemical cascade and then this physical protection that served, ironically, as shelter and protection for the insect, produced tannins, which then could be used as this long-lasting ink.
Very long-lasting. We still have these documents.
That's right. That's right.
The book is really an exploration of all of these things. It's split up into different sections, working with insects, making insects, becoming them. I think people are going to be most familiar with this first section, the idea of working with insects. But this, of course, takes a lot of different forms. What are some of the common ways that we work with insects, products that they might give us or that we use them for?
This was so much fun to explore and pretty easy for me to categorize because first I thought about the products, as you mentioned, what are insects producing and how can we exploit the insects with these products for our gain? And then how do we use body parts or whole bodies, dead, alive of insects? You've got some ancient and long-lasting uses from silk to bees, wax, honey, to true bugs, lacquer, colors, and then paper inspired by insects, chitin, venoms and poisons that have been used to either cure, kill, or transform. I start with silk just because it's probably the most important in some ways. And it's such a strange history because there are very few insects that we've domesticated. And for 5,000 years, we've domesticated this one. Out of over 180,000 species of moths and butterflies, this one, Bombyx mori, and to such an extent that they can no longer fly in nature. So here we've got this silk that we use not only for fabrics and textiles, some little scraps of which exist from thousands of years ago, so it's long lasting, but also it has other utilitarian value. It's very consistent, it's super strong. and somewhat flexible. And of course, it has that luster. So people have used it in ways that involve optics, little guides, whether it be observational equipment for astronomy or for the military. If we depart from silkworm moths to black widow spider silk or other spider silk, there were farms in the U.S. during World War I and II to produce the silk to use in those ways. And even World War I explosives from the U.S., 100% of them were delivered in silk pouches, because silk has this weird property where if it burns or explodes, it doesn't leave ash or any residue behind. If I were to guess, I'd say that of all the insect products, silk is probably number one in terms of being represented in museums and galleries and people's homes, either as canvases or as piecemeal parts holding things together. And that's just a fiber that's used to produce a cocoon so an insect can pupate or go through full metamorphosis to winged adulthood. Then you look at products like honeybees' wax and honey and propolis, and our history of robbing colonies to keeping colonies, and even looking to them in terms of their decision-making and their efficient division of labor. And then you've got the true bugs in the order Hemiptera. So all bugs are insects, but not all insects are bugs. So the bugs belonging to this one order have piercing, sucking mouthparts as immatures and adults. And some of them don't look insect-like at all, even as adults. And these are the scale bugs. And one species of scale bug produces the only animal resin that humans have exploited, and that's lac turned shellac. And you'll see those coat sculptures, coat wood floors, coat furniture. Lac was used to make 78 RPM records. Dyes, red dyes in textiles. So the list goes on and on and on. We used to spray our hair and use it in cosmetics and paint our nails, as well as dye our clothes. So the lac bug has been super important, as has the cochineal bug that are raised in Sonora, Mexico, and Oaxaca, for example. And these true bugs that produce this, what Amy Butler Greenfield in a beautiful book called The Perfect Red, a brilliant scarlet, and depending on what mordant you use with a fabric, can range from this brilliant red all the way to a purple. And it was so valued that when the Spanish conquistadors exported it by the tons, second only to silver exports from the Aztec and Maya people to the Old World, the Old World went crazy over this red.
Now, one of the things your book explores is this idea of kind of making insects, or at least remaking them in a way that suits our purposes. How have insects inspired engineers of all types?
Oh, in so many ways. So when I talk about fabricating insects, that can take many, many forms, either by engineers, by architects, by artists and others. So if we think about engineers using biomimicry or mimicking nature, there are solutions that have played out over hundreds of millions of years by insects. And those same solutions from head to tarsus could be applied to engineering problems that humans face. And so there are countless examples. I just skim a little surface of examples that I was really excited about in the book to explore these mimicries, these engineering marvels from insect origins. Some can be from the compound eyes of insects. Some can be from the wings of insects. Some can be looking at how insects move across uneven terrain in order to build robots. Some will match the decentralized control across a number of robots that try to mimic ants or other colonial insects, for example. Some of my favorite examples involve artists trying to exquisitely replicate insects either in part or in toto. So for example, there's an artist, Haruo Mitsuo, in Japan, who applies a really old cultural practice, Jizai Okimono, which is to take either fantastical creatures or real organisms like insects and replicate them in metal, but not only in metal, articulated so that you can pull open the sheath-like four wings of a beetle and unfold or unravel the wings, the hind wings of the beetle, and move each leg segment and move the mandibles. So Jizai Okimono is one way, but also largely from Japan, origami. And there are some spectacular examples. There was a battle of the bugs in the 1980s and 90s to try to do more and more complicated foldings to replicate insects in their intricate ways. And then you've got my friend Bill Logan, who would produce flies for fly fishing. And he'll create realistic fly ties in 12 minutes or hyper-realistic fly ties in over 100 hours. And when I was first exposed, and I'm an entomologist who works with a lot of different insects, when I was first exposed to photographs and real specimens of his work, I was fooled. I'd have to turn over an insect to see the big hook from the venter. And the list goes on. I used to make natural history displays, so I'd fabricate insects molding and casting elements or directly fabricating them from looking at the originals. And just observing your subjects through illustration or through this 3D fabrication, you really get to know your subjects well.
The final thing that you explore in this book kind of gets to this idea of really analyzing insects, exploring their bodies, and learning in some ways, things about the human condition through insects, whether that's being inspired in how we dress, how we dance, and also how we fight. How has the insect world influenced how humans behave?
Really great question. And it's a lot of ways. I mentioned this idea of decentralized control. And it's the idea that you don't have one overbearing ruler that makes all the decisions, but rather you spread out the decision-making across a collective and see what emerges most democratically. And I think one of the most effective examinations was by Tom Seeley in The Honeybee Democracy, where in the last chapter, he looks at human decision-making. And he was struck with being a chairperson for his neurobiology behavior department. And he decided to look to his honeybees. How do they make decisions? Could I apply that to human decision-making? And he analyzed the five different steps or criteria that allow people to do so effectively, at least under some circumstances. So we could even think not just in terms of democratic voting and making decisions where numbers drive the behaviors, but we could also look at how traffic flows and municipal decision-making has looked to ants and other insects. How do they cart around these heavy things like leaf cutter ants carrying around their parasol, their little cut leaf fragments from the high canopy of a tree to their subterranean fungal cultivars as agriculturists, as farmers for 55 million years. And we can look at the flow where it looks maybe a little sloppy at first, but then you see, wow, this is efficient in a way that maybe traffic jams could be alleviated or carting material goods could be augmented. So there are a lot of ways decision-making and municipal practices could benefit by examining the collective decision-making and the collective practices of insects.
When you think about this book as a whole, what do you hope people take away from it?
My biggest hope, my not-so-hidden agenda, is that people not only tolerate the quintillions of insects around us, this most diverse of arthropods, 60% of all animal species, at least described, probably way more undescribed, are represented by these hexapod neighbors of ours, but that we begin to deeply appreciate them, taking the time out to observe so that we can celebrate these marvels all around us that are sadly diminishing at our hands. Instead, if we look at their myriad ways of affecting not only ecosystem services on which we depend, but the cultural services that have changed and shaped us as a species, I think we'd be in a better world.
Yeah. Well, Barrett, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
My pleasure. I always love talking about insects. Thank you so much.
Barrett Klein is an animal behavior biologist and entomologist at UW-La Crosse. His new book is The Insect Epiphany, How Our Six-Legged Allies Shape Human Culture. Klein spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. And that wraps up the show for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Geneva Lake is Wisconsin's first inland lake where an invasive mussel has shown up. We'll learn how that's being managed tomorrow on Lake Effect. We'll also learn about the geological origins of Cream City Brick and its use in one of Milwaukee's earliest strip malls. Join us tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.